My friends, this is Dr. Beter. Today is October 29, 1977, and this is my audio letter number 27. 15 years ago yesterday, on October 28, 1962, America breathed a sigh of relief as the Cuban Missile Crisis ended in surrender by the Soviet Union. On that Sunday morning, Radio Moscow announced that all work on the offensive missile sites in Cuba was being stopped and that they would be dismantled under United Nations observation. So ended 6 days in which the world teetered visibly on the brink of nuclear war, thanks to a dangerous Soviet gamble. The public crisis had begun with a televised speech by President John F. Kennedy on Monday evening, October 22, 1962. Tens of millions of Americans huddled before our TV sets, having been told in news reports all day long that something big was afoot. When President Kennedy told us that Soviet offensive nuclear missiles were almost operational in Cuba, some Americans were taken by surprise, others were not. Those who were not surprised had heard the warnings of the late Senator Kenneth Keene of New York. For more than a year, he had been warning about the Cuban missiles in speeches nationwide. But many other Americans were shocked to hear about the missiles from President Kennedy that evening. Some had never heard Senator Keating's earlier warnings, thanks to a major media blackout on the story. Others had heard, but they had believed the denials issued by the government. But what was stunning to everyone, the Kremlin included, was the response by President Kennedy to the Cuban missile threat. Avoiding use of the word blockade, which in international law is an act of war, President Kennedy announced a so-called quarantine on offensive shipments to Cuba. It would be enforced by what was then the most powerful navy on earth, the United States Navy. Furthermore, the President demanded that the missile sites be dismantled and Soviet forces withdrawn. Otherwise, stronger action by America was threatened. Then came the bone-chilling words, quote, "Any missile launched from Cuba against any nation shall be regarded as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring full retaliation," unquote. Refusing to pretend that Cuba was the culprit, Jack Kennedy confronted the Soviet Union head-on. And in terms of the one thing that commands Soviet respect, military power, the great historian Carol Quigley, who passed away early this year, summarized the circumstances of the Cuba crisis very accurately in his monumental work, Tragedy and Hope, published by Macmillan in 1966. Quote, "The dominant fact in the whole situation was the overwhelming character of America's power, and the fact that this was known both to the White House and to the Kremlin, but was largely unknown and certainly unpublicized to the world. Around the Soviet Union's border were 144 Polaris, 103 Atlas, 159 Thor, Jupiter, and Titan missiles, 1,600 long-range bombers, many of them constantly in the air with nuclear bombs." When the President's speech began the public crisis, 5 divisions of the United States Army Strategic Reserve, totaling about 100,000 men, plus 100,000 Air Force and an equal number of Naval and Marine personnel, had been mobilized or alerted. The 1st Armored Division had been flown from Texas to the East Coast. 90 naval vessels, including 8 carriers, were on patrol to blockade. A Cuban invasion command had been assembled in Florida. And 2,700 relatives of military personnel had been evacuated from Guantanamo. Under such pressure, Khrushchev wilted. It might almost be said that he panicked on Friday, October the 26th. Unquote. And 2 days later, Radio Moscow made the announcement giving in to Kennedy's demands. Many critics have pointed out that after the crisis itself, America seemingly left needless loopholes for Soviet cheating in the Cuban withdrawal process. But regardless of that, it was the overwhelming power of America that prevented nuclear war in the Cuban crisis itself. 2 years before the Cuban crisis, General Nathan Twining, retiring as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, warned America, quote, "Forces that cannot win will not deter," unquote. These few words of common sense distill the lessons of several thousand years of military history. And in October 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis proved that they are as true in the nuclear age as they ever were before. One would think that such a close brush with nuclear disaster would have alerted the American people to the realities of survival in an enduring way, but it did not. The 4-to-1 military advantage over Russia enjoyed by America in 1962 was not brought home to the American public as the critical factor that had prevented a war. It was only later, in context with words like overkill, measured response, and mutual assured destruction, that our previous military preponderance was brought to public attention. And the purpose then was to whittle it down to nothing. But if the American people failed to learn the lesson of Cuba, the Kremlin did not. The lesson was learned best of all by Leonid Brezhnev, Khrushchev's rocket boss. Khrushchev's failure in the Cuban Missile affair was the beginning of the end for him in the Kremlin. Yet, ironically, when Khrushchev was deposed in 1964, it was none other than Brezhnev who had actually masterminded the Cuban Missile Plan who took Khrushchev's place. And Brezhnev was determined that the Soviet Union would not again suffer such a debacle. Today, the similarities to the Cuban Missile Crisis are striking. Now as then, we are again targeted with short-range nuclear missiles, except this time they are lurking within our own territorial waters, ready for underwater launch upon satellite command. Now as then, the Soviet missile crisis has been underway for more than a year, and the American people are kept ignorant of the facts by the major media blackout of the story and by government denials. And now as then, the dominant fact is the lopsided military advantage possessed by one side. But this time, it isn't just missiles that threaten us. It also includes underwater nuclear mines strewn throughout our own country by Soviet agents. And again, the public is being deceived jointly by the federal government and the controlled major media, not merely by silence and denials, but by propaganda that helps to cover up hostilities that are already being directed against us by our enemy. Worst of all, the lopsided military imbalance now favors not America, but the Soviet Union. During the past month, unusually rapid, puzzling, and dramatic changes have begun sweeping across the international arena. In the Middle East, 3 years of Soviet eclipse have suddenly been ended by a joint Soviet-American declaration. And in the process, a drastic change in American policy toward Israel has surfaced. Red China, after a decade of bitter struggling with the Soviet Union, suddenly began making concrete moves toward reconciliation with Russia early this month. India's Prime Minister Desai, who used to denounce communism, traveled to Moscow early this month and now says India's friendship with the Soviet Union is, quote, cemented, unquote. News and commentary suddenly assure us that a thaw is taking place between the Soviet Union and the United States. And on all sides, disarmament has all of a sudden become the overriding topic in world affairs. These developments and many more have all come about since America's disastrous defeat by the Soviet Union last month on September 27, 1977, in the still secret battle of the harvest moon. This was history's first full-fledged space battle. And as I told you in detail last month in audio letter number 26, the Soviet Union emerged as the only possessor of the decisive new particle beam weapon. It is this Soviet military breakthrough that is at the root of what now looks like an avalanche of diplomatic breakthroughs involving the Soviet Union all over the world. As it stands now, my friends, the cold, hard truth is this. The Soviet Union could attack the United States now and win. But American retaliation could, nevertheless, inflict considerable suffering on Russia as the price of such a Soviet conquest. And they prefer to destroy us without suffering themselves. And that is the direction in which events are now moving. My three topics for today are topic number one, the Soviet particle beam and killer satellites. Topic number two, the spreading atomic plague called Legionnaire's disease. And topic number three, the enforced disarming of America now underway. Topic number one, last month in audio letter number 26, recorded September 30, 1977, I revealed the fact that the Soviet Union has become the first nation on earth to possess a new super weapon, the particle beam, which is now deployed in Earth orbit. The first particle beam killer satellite was launched 3 months ago on July 17, 1977, and is known as Cosmos 929. As I told you last month, the first operational test against the target was carried out over the Soviet Union during the early hours of September 20, 1977. An American spy satellite was blasted into a huge fireball that was seen hundreds of miles away. Exactly 2 weeks later, on October 4, 1977, Secretary of Defense Harold Brown held a news conference in which he shocked everyone with the unexpected words, and I quote, "There is a fact of Soviet anti-satellite, not only development, but operational capability," unquote. And he added, quote, "That's something of concern to me, because we rely a good deal on our space systems for support of our military capability, which capability I think contributes to deterring, preventing war," unquote. After Dr. Brown spoke, other defense officials singled out our low-flying spy satellites as being vulnerable to the Soviet killer satellites, which are also known as Cosmos interceptors. However, neither Dr. Brown nor the other spokesman would explain for the record and for the American people how the new Cosmos interceptors work. After all, the Russians know. Reporters were therefore left with nothing to suggest in their articles except the 10-year-old Soviet anti-satellite concept of an explosive interceptor, which would maneuver close to the target and then blow up. The fact that particle beam weapons are involved was not mentioned. In January of this year, the outgoing Pentagon Research Director, Dr. Malcolm Curry, gave Congress a warning. He said that it would be catastrophic to let the Soviets gain an advantage over us in the area of anti-satellite weapons, and no wonder. Satellites today play a central role in the military communications, intelligence gathering, and early warning of any possible attack. Unusual troop movements or other preparations for attack can be detected, and even the firing of ICBMs will be detected only by satellites. Without our spy satellites, we would be blinded to any surprise attack by strategic missiles. And yet, the SALT II Accord, which Jimmy Carter is now working so feverishly to promote, includes no provision at all against anti-satellite weapons. As I reported in audio letter 26 at the end of last month, 4 days before Dr. Brown's stunning announcement about operational Soviet killer satellites, there were two Cosmos 929 class interceptors in orbit. Now there are eight. And now the Soviet Union is picking off American strategic satellites one by one, creating a tremendous fireball each time like the one I described to you last month. On October 13, earlier this month, CBS Radio News reported that a number of people have expressed concern about seeing several fireballs over Russia. They inquired what they could be, thinking they might be UFOs from outer space. But a Russian scientist who was interviewed about it said the fireballs were nothing to worry about, that they were merely Cosmos phenomena. And of course he was telling the truth in a tongue-in-cheek way, since the recent astonishing fireball phenomena are caused by Cosmos particle beam interceptors. But the granddaddy of all the fireballs so far was the one which erupted over the United States on the evening of October 18, just 11 days ago. Hundreds of witnesses reported seeing the huge fireball all the way from the McDonald Observatory in extreme southwest Texas to points over 700 miles away in Arkansas and Missouri, as well as in the neighboring states of Oklahoma and Louisiana. It was so bright that people hundreds of miles apart thought it had hit near them, and so huge that astronomers said it should have reached the ground. But according to radar and military observers, it exploded in midair with a bright flash. Whether any pieces survived to hit the ground is not known at this time. Thus, the 85-ton American space station known as Skylab, launched 4 years ago, came to a spectacular end at the hands of a Soviet Cosmos interceptor. The Soviet Union wanted to ensure that Skylab could not be pressed into service by America in any way to begin to undo the fast-growing Soviet domination of space. And just in case any chunks of the big space station should reach the ground without burning out, thereby possibly doing damage or injury, Skylab was destroyed over the United States instead of over the Soviet Union. 9 days later, the government released an elaborate cover story about Skylab by way of the CBS Evening News for October 27, 1977. While we were shown official NASA film of Skylab in orbit, we were told that for some strange reason, Skylab's orbit is decaying sooner than expected, and that it might well come down prematurely. Now, my friends, if someone should find pieces of it lying around, the groundwork has already been laid for a future public explanation. The Soviet use of their new particle beam weapon to blow our strategic satellites out of the sky is bad enough, but this is only the beginning. As I explained in detail last month, America's secret moon base in Copernicus Crater was put out of action on September 27, 1977. It was bombarded with a Soviet neutron particle beam, which killed all of our astronauts there. The Copernicus base was itself equipped with particle beam weaponry, but was defeated by the Soviet Union just before achieving operational status. Thus, America lost the Battle of the Harvest Moon, and though this space battle is still a secret, its consequences are cropping up all around us. In topics number 2 and 3, I will try to bring you up to date on what has happened militarily and diplomatically as a result of our losing the Battle of the Harvest Moon. Right now, though, let me tell you the latest developments in space itself. On September 29, 1977, just 2 days after the Battle of the Harvest Moon and the Gromyko ultimatum to Jimmy Carter, the Soviet Union launched Salyut Space Station No. 6. This was the same day that an Atlas Centaur rocket became the second American rocket in 2 weeks to explode during launch. The orbiting of Salyut 6, my friends, signaled the beginning of the first Soviet manned mission to the moon. And the next day, as the Soviet moon era was just dawning, the sun set on America's moon era. The NASA Space Center in Houston radioed remote control commands to the moon to shut down all automated equipment still operating there. And as usual, the quiet and largely unnoticed news reports about it told us this was being done to save money. On October 9, Soyuz 25 was launched with a two-man crew to rendezvous with Salyut 6. And just as the crew of Apollo 11 carried an American flag with them to plant on the moon, the crew of Soyuz 25 took a copy of the newly adopted Soviet Constitution with them. As mission commander Kovalyanuk climbed aboard the spacecraft, he gave not the usual friendly wave, but a clenched fist salute for the benefit of the television audience. Then Soyuz 25 lifted off from the same pad at the Baikonur Cosmodrome that had been used 20 years ago to launch Sputnik 1. Less than 2 days later, Radio Moscow broke a 24-hour silence about the mission, which had caused many observers to wonder if the cosmonauts might have suffered harm. It was announced that the cosmonauts were in good condition and that their Soyuz 25 capsule had landed safely. Supposedly, the mission had been aborted because of the failure of Soyuz 25 to dock successfully with Salyut 6. But actually, my friends, Soyuz 25 was successful in its rendezvous with Salyut 6. The purpose was not to dock and remain in orbit, but rather to link up to a lunar propulsion and equipment module, and this Soyuz 25 did. By the time Radio Moscow broke its silence with a cover story about an aborted mission, Soyuz 25 was on its way to the moon. On October 16, after achieving lunar orbit, the crew of Soyuz 25 detached a radio relay package and left it in lunar orbit as they descended to the lunar surface. And just as two Americans named Armstrong and Aldrin became the first human beings to set foot on the near side of the moon, two Russians named Kovalyanuk and Ryumin have become the first to land on the far side of the moon in Jules Verne crater. The Soviet Union is now working rapidly to do the same thing that the controlled United States government had tried to do, to set up a particle beam weapons base on the moon from which to menace the Earth. The operation now underway in Jules Verne crater is strictly an interim step. The backside of the moon is being used purely as a safe haven, and there, all preliminary preparations can be made without any chance, they hope, of observation or retaliation by the United States. The plan is to assemble everything that is needed for an initial particle beam installation, including equipment, crews of cosmonauts, life support equipment, and so forth, in a safe backside location. Then, rockets will be used to transport everything to the intended location on the near side, rapidly and all at once. If all goes according to plan, the Soviet particle beam base will be able to become operational very quickly after the fast move to the near side. In this way, the Soviet Union expects to have its particle beam moon base in operation and able to protect itself before any conceivable preemptive strike could knock it out. They have no wish to suffer the same fate they themselves inflicted a month ago on the secret American moon base. Once it is operational with a charged particle beam weapon to protect itself, the Soviet moon base will be relatively secure in a military sense. This is especially true since a small fleet of Cosmos interceptors are now in Earth orbit, armed as they are with particle beam weapons. Therefore, once the Soviet moon base is in operation on the near side of the moon, the Soviet Union may well choose to make it known to the world, neglecting, of course, to explain its true purpose. If so, it will be a startling echo of the early days of the Soviet space program, when spectacular exploits in space were always announced only after they were successfully underway, never beforehand. According to my latest intelligence on the Soviet moon mission, the project is progressing very rapidly. As of 2 days ago, October 27, the crew of Soyuz 25 have already been joined at Jules Verne crater by additional cosmonauts, and the components for a particle beam weapon have also arrived. At this rate, the space lift of crew and equipment to the near side of the moon might come very soon. And if it does, the timing would be perfect for Soviet propaganda purposes. The 20th anniversary of Sputnik 1, which was October 4, was commemorated by launching Soyuz 25 from the same launch pad as was used for Sputnik 1. Still ahead on November 7th is the 60th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. How better to impress the world with the vigor of a Soviet system than by having the brand new Soviet Constitution praised over worldwide television by a cosmonaut broadcasting from the moon.